Now Monitor brings you Meet the Press, the prize-winning interview program produced by Lawrence Spivak. Four of America's top news reporters are ready for this spontaneous, unrehearsed news conference. Here's the moderator of Meet the Press, Ned Brooks.
Welcome once again to Meet the Press. This week, the Kaiser Steel Corporation broke the united front of the steel industry and signed an agreement with the Steelworkers Union. The man responsible was Board Chairman Edgar Kaiser, who is our guest today. Mr. Kaiser is president and director of the Kaiser Industries Corporation, the central company in the billion-dollar industrial organization established by his famous father, Mr. Henry Kaiser. Together, they set up operations in steel, aluminum, construction, shipbuilding, and automobiles. They have long had a reputation for independent action. Mr. Edgar Kaiser was still in his 20s when he helped to superintend the building of the Hoover and the Bonneville dams. Seated around the press table today, ready to interview Mr. Kaiser, are Richard Wilson of the Coles Publications, A.H. Raskin of the New York Times, John Steele of Time and Life magazines, and Lawrence E. Spivak, our regular member of the Meet the Press panel. Now, Mr. Kaiser, if you're ready, we'll start the questions with Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Kaiser, there have been differing reports as to why you left the other 11 big steel companies to make an individual agreement. Will you tell us briefly and in your own words just why you did?
Yes, Mr. Spivak. First, we thought that the area of settlement was at a point where we could reach an agreement that was a good agreement, non-inflationary, and that our people could go back to work. Secondly, we had always said that we didn't hope that an agreement could be concluded before the Taft-Hartley injunction. Because under Taft-Hartley, you have a situation where you would have the union on one side, the company on the other side, each pressing their own form of contract. And it seemed to us that there'd be constant conflict, you'd have low production, you might get into serious areas of argument. The people themselves would be insecure as to whether they were going back to work or not.
Well, Mr. Kaiser, when you made your deal with the union, did you act only in your own interest, or did you believe that the signing of the agreement might force the rest of the industry to an early settlement?
I didn't think about it that way, Mr. Spivak. Many people have thought that it was because it was of special circumstances that the Kaisers could sign up. I thought about it just the way I told you.
Well, but didn't you also say at the time that you thought it was the only responsible step you can take in the face of mounting national emergency?
That's correct, but we were in an area where I felt the industry could make a settlement.
Well, I know, but did you hope to ease the national emergency by settling for Kaiser when you produced only 2%?
I think it does do that, but I really wasn't thinking about that. I was thinking about my responsibility. My responsibility and ours as Kaiser Steel was to find an area of agreement and get the people back to work.
Mr. Steel.
Mr. Kaiser, some folks say that you represent only 2% of steel production, but 98% of the industry's brains. Is that right?
Well, thank you very much.
Well, I'm not
but
saying
I don't
that
think
I'm
that's
asking...
right, Mr. Steele.
Well, let me ask you more seriously. What kind of pressure did your colleagues in the steel industry place upon you not to break with their united front and not to sign with the union?
Well, Mr. Steele, the decision to leave a group of men who share common responsibilities from a personal standpoint, I want to assure you, was a difficult one. From a principal standpoint, I felt it was the only thing we could do. And we had been talking about it some time. And all I am to say to you the same thing I said to my colleagues. This, we are at a point where we can settle, we should settle.
But
now,
Mr. Kaiser, what kind of pressure was put on you to try to keep you from settling when you did?
None.
Well, in mid-October, there was a good deal of talk at that time of a settlement between you and the steel people, and you abandoned efforts and said that you wouldn't make a separate peace, that you wanted to make an industry-wide settlement.
That's correct.
Was that as a result of pressure?
No, Mr. Steele, that was a result of free collective bargaining.
Well, I think that you're in your
Let
other...
Me, can I explain
Certainly.
It to you?
Certainly.
Look, at this point, I had been working back and forth between the union and the industry, fully disclosing my conversations with both sides. In that, when you get yourself into that position, and particularly when that news in the last few weeks began to leak in the press, it was the opinion of the industry group that there was a hope, let us say, while I had no commitment of any kind with the union, other than as an industry man, loud and clear, that the industry felt there'd be a hope. And how, a hope what, that the Kaiser Steel would sign up? How could you possibly, the industry bargain, could Cooper bargain, if we were sitting off there in a position where the union could say, well, we've been talking to Edgar about this, so therefore I've issued a public statement that we would not sign separately to assist in the bargaining negotiations of industry.
Well, what changed your mind, sir?
What changed my mind was that we had arrived at a point where I was satisfied this was non-inflationary, that it was the kind of a thing we could live with. And furthermore, on the issue of 2B, the contract language, we did have a difference of opinion with the union.
Mr. Raskin.
Mr. Kaiser, you say this is a non-inflationary agreement. Does that mean that you will not raise the price of steel during the life of this agreement?
I can't answer that question, Mr. Raskin,
but
I can tell you why I say it's a non-inflationary agreement. The industry itself, last formal offer, was 33 cents for a three-year period, as you know. That's an average. That's 33 cents an hour, and that's an average of 11 cents per year. Our settlement is 11 and a quarter cents per year, and I don't think you can figure it much closer than that.
Well, except that the industry does not accept your basis of calculation, and the union does not accept the industry's basis of calculation. What you say is 22 and a half cents, the industry says is 32 cents. What they say is 33 cents. The union says is 24. So we're really involved in a numbers game in which nobody is accepting anyone else's premise as to what any particular agreement costs.
I don't think there's been any question on the part of the industry as to Kaiser Steel's cost. We know our cost, Mr. Raskin. Our costs are estimated at 11 and a quarter cents, and they'll be pretty close to that. They may be lower as a result of these committees. Now, when you come to the industry figures, I can't speak for the industry as to why they say something that costs us 11 and a quarter cents a year costs them something different.
Well, we're in a realm of figures that nobody has been able to reconcile, and I know that we're not going to do it on this program, so let me just abandon that and return to this question of inflation and the impact
right.
of this settlement on inflation. Would it not have been better, in your judgment, Mr. Kaiser, in terms of the prime national necessity of trying to do something about the price spiral, to have settled on the basis that the industry originally proposed of a wage freeze and a holding of the line on prices with some certainty, or even better, as many of us think, a price cut?
Kaiser Steel did settle on that basis. Kaiser Steel's settlement in the first year, there's no wage increase. I believe that you and I can agree, Mr. Raskin, that in the second year, in the area where there is a wage increase, the difference between what the industry says its costs are and Kaiser says its costs are, very little. The area of difference is in the first year, in the fringe benefits. Now, if those fringe benefits, in fact, will not cost us any more than 10 cents in that first year, which they won't, and if it is true that it will cost the industry more, are you saying that it is better to keep 12,000 people out of work because when Kaiser Steel can sign up on a non-inflationary agreement that the sense that the industry has already said is all right, are you saying it's better to keep those people out of work?
I think it's a very commendable thing to get them back to work.
I'm not
on
looking
the other
for
hand,
commendation.
As you know, the industry's
it's a question
basic
of responsibility.
Objection is not one of wanting to keep 500,000 people out of work. They say that they cannot settle on these terms without promoting inflation.
Well, Mr. Raskin, then let's move on. I mean, let's get to where you're really taking me, I think. But maybe you better ask me, because I don't think it's all economic in this issue.
Well, I'd like to have your judgment on is the real precipitating factor in this whole dispute.
I think there's...
Is there any point to it?
Well, I don't think so at the present time, or we wouldn't have signed up.
And you feel that what was true for you is true for the rest of the industry?
Mr. Raskin, yes, I really think so in my heart. I frankly do. I think the industry is a point where it can settle.
Well,
but it isn't my prerogative. I don't have the information to know exactly what it costs them. Because this area of 7 to 10 cents in the first year where there's a difference, you and I can agree on the pensions. Maybe we have some younger people. Our average age limit. Maybe it could cost us a cent or two less in that area. On the other hand, I know, that, and the industry knows, that Kaiser Steel's insurance program costs it 2.5 cents more than the industry. I don't understand these figures, but I know our figures.
Well, I don't like to monopolize the microphone, but let me just, since I think we're really at a very crucial point in this thing, are you suggesting that the industry is doing one of two things, either embarked on a Don Quixote venture that is of great destructiveness to the country, or that its basic objective in this is to break the union and in that way to achieve some long-range good that it foresees in that?
I think it's a question you ought to address to the industry. I can tell you what we did and why we did it.
Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Kaiser, I wonder if your action... in signing, let's call it a separate peace with Mr. McDonald, doesn't in fact give you a jump on your competitors?
Well, I suppose... what do you mean by a jump? Do you mean because on the West Coast we'll get a little more business as a result of this?
Yes, that's what I mean.
No, I don't think so, because the shortage of steel is so critical on the coast that I really don't think that there's going to be any difference at all. Sure, we will have a few more weeks of operation, but I'm hopeful that either through Taft-Hartley or through agreement, the industry will be at work soon.
Well, suppose they go back to work under Taft-Hartley. They go back under their own contract, do they not?
Yes.
Then you are at a competitive disadvantage.
That's correct.
Suppose that Congress passes a law which keeps these men at their work after the expiration of the Taft-Hartley period.
We'd continue to be at that competitive disadvantage, but then I think you have to analyze what that is. You see, the industry figures that, that there's a 2.6 increase in productivity normally over the period of 1947 to 1957. That's been the history. Now, our settlement, the Kaiser settlement, is about a little less than 3%. So that means that we have to pick up about 4%, let's say, 0.4%, rather, in that period of 2 years. I think we can do that. We have some other factors. I'd like to think we're as efficient as this difference that's discussed, but we think we're efficient, but we're not sure where that goes.
Some of your colleagues in the industry say that there is no assurance whatsoever that your increase in wages and other benefits will be matched by an increase in productivity equal to it.
Well, if there has been a productivity increase over the last 10 years of an average of 2.6%, why isn't it reasonable to think it may continue? In our case in particular, we've just doubled our tonnage. We've gone from 1.5 million to 3 million tons. The new 1.5 million tons is the new oxygen process, which admittedly produces lower cost steel.
Aren't you getting yourself into a position there when you go make an agreement for continuous negotiation on work rules, of establishing some kind of a new labor management relationship which may bear a relationship to those Proposals made by Walter Reuther a few years ago. He doesn't make them anymore, but he wanted labor to sit in on management in a certain degree. I wonder if you haven't taken that step.
Well, I think that the industry must take a step to solve what's been going on. The country cannot stand this continual period. We run up to a deadline and then we have a strike.
Is the way to do it to give labor a larger voice in management?
I don't think you're talking about a larger voice in labor. I think it's a mutual problem. That's the fundamental difference, I guess, between Kaiser and the rest of the industry. I think you have to do it that way.
And they say it's just the beginning toward a corporate state.
Well, I'm not so sure that that's so. If you and I are doing something because we mutually agree to it, I think we'll do it a little better than we will if we've done it either because I have a unilateral power or you do.
You'll make the union stronger and stronger.
Well, if the union gains responsibility with strength, that's to the asset of the country.
Mr. Spivak.
Well, Mr. Kaiser, you've been on the inside of these negotiations now for some time. Can you tell us what you believe is the major obstacle now to a settlement of the steel strike between the union and the big steel companies?
Yes, I think it's the question of the contract language. I think there's a sincere and fundamental belief on the part of the industry that they must correct a condition which they've been unable to correct and that they must do it unilaterally.
Well, contract language, did you say?
That's correct.
You mean the question of cost is not involved, the question of work rules is not involved, just language?
Well, no, that's not so, because the changes in the language do have an effect on the cost. In other words, if the contract language is changed so that management unilaterally can say, we'll establish, and this is with regard to past practice, because we're only talking about that, with regard to what's happened in the past, we can change it, and then the union can grieve, and then it can be settled by arbitration if it isn't settled. That's the real fundamental issue, I believe.
Now, this seems like a major struggle, you say, over language between a powerful union and a powerful industry.
That's correct.
Having been on the inside and knowing both sides, have you any suggestion as to how this thing can best be settled now? Or must it go on until it destroys the country?
I believe, Mr. Spivak, that the committee that we have for that very purpose, it is a joint committee, equal number from the union, equal number from management. It has two duties. It has a duty to study these particular problems and an authority to resolve. Now, on the company side, the company can say, but it must, the industries can say, but it must be mutual. You can't get anywhere.
No, but you've already settled. I mean, I'm talking
we've
now
settled,
about
but that
how
I
best
think
to
is
settle. Have you any suggestion how this strike can be settled?
Yes, I believe that the adoption of those committees is the proper way to settle this strike.
You mean settle first and appoint the committee and let the committee then decide what goes on?
No, it doesn't work that way. In our we have an economic settlement. That's done. And in our contract, we have these two committees. One to find the answer to the long-range problem so we don't run into this again, and one to resolve these issues. I believe that those issues must be resolved mutually.
Well, one other question. If the industry gets a better deal than you in a final settlement, what happens to your contract? Will you get the better terms, too?
No. There is no favored nation provision in our contract.
Mr. Kaiser, I didn't quite understand your answer to Mr. Raskin about whether or not you're going to have to raise prices. Now, are you or aren't you?
Well, I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I do not believe so.
You think there's a good chance that this can be absorbed?
I think there is.
Nope. Now, what about the other steel companies? They maintain that productivity will increase at a far slower pace than if they settle on the same terms you did. Do you agree with them?
Well, that comes back to the question as to whether or not it does, in fact, cost them substantially more, this same settlement.
Is it your off-the-top-of-the-head guess that they will have to increase prices if they settle at your figures?
Well, they have said they would.
Do you believe them?
I think you better ask them the question.
All right, sir.
Mr. Raskin.
Just
To what extent, Mr. Kaiser, do you feel that you really have assisted in helping towards the settlement of the overall situation? Do you feel that it isn't just possible that by making your separate agreement, you have so frozen the union's attitude that it's going to be impossible, in the light of what you know to be the very deeply felt resistance of the rest of the industry, going to be pretty hopeless to ever settle this thing?
That's a good question, Mr. Raskin. I think we've helped the industry. I think when history records this, it will be that we've done a service. And I'm not trying to wave a flag. Look, we have made a settlement which does cost Kaiser Steel 11¼ cents. Now, if you were on the other side of the bargaining table for the industry, sitting with the union over here, I would think you would say, look, you have settled with one company. You, the union, admit that it's 11¼ cents. The company admits it's 11¼ cents. Why is it fair that a settlement should be made with the rest of industry on any other basis?
Well, as you well know...
Doesn't it establish a groundwork, and it's so close to what the industry already offered?
On the second year, there's no question that you're within a penny of what they have offered.
Talk the whole settlement.
On the first year, because of the... And this is something that just impossible to try to unravel on a television program. But as you know, there is not much comparability between your pension and insurance problem and theirs. And there is a reasonable basis.
And as you know, our hospital costs us 2.5 cents more.
I wouldn't quarrel that you do a much better job.
But let's go to your point. You cannot split it by years. I quite agree. You must take the total package. So let's say it in total package. If it costs the Kaiser Steel Corporation, union and industry agree, 22.5 cents for a two-year period, how about a settlement that costs the industry the same?
I mean, if they just offered to drop that into a pot and then say, let's see what we can buy for it, that might be a basis.
There should be some bargaining going on, and I'm saying if you and I were bargaining and you were on the industry side, you'd be saying this to me, I'm sure.
I've got a pen. I'm ready to sign.
Mr. Wilson.
Mr. Kaiser, in spite of the fact that you settled, you represent a very small, relatively small percentage. I'm not saying that your business isn't large, but a small percentage of the steel production. Do you think that they are actually going to settle on any basis such as you have outlined?
Yes, I think that the final settlement will come very close with respect to the economic package to where we are, and that I'm again saying that that's what it'll cost them when the final signatures are put there. With regard to the question of the contract language, I really don't know what'll happen there. This may be a much deeper issue.
You know, I think probably President Eisenhower struck a pretty responsive chord when he said he was sick and tired of this. I wonder if the public isn't pretty sick and tired of it, too. Do you think... the Taft-Hartley Act is sufficient to deal with a problem of this kind?
Well, I had hoped that it was, but I really think that you're going to a more serious issue now. When industry and labor cannot get together and settle their own differences, which is where this thing has finally gone, I think that the very thing that we in industry and in the country believe in, which is the free, so-called free enterprise system. All we're doing is making it less of a free enterprise system when we don't step up to our responsibility, because somebody is going to say to us, amend the Taft-Hartley so that somebody else settles it for you.
Well, what do you think of that proposition?
I don't think it's good.
You would be against any amendment that would require a settlement?
I think I can answer it this way. I voted for, within the industry group, arbitration, when arbitration was offered, because the industry felt this was an answer for them. But I said always, we won't even put it in our contract unless the union insists on it.
Do you think industry is being so stubborn on this whole point that it wishes a revision of the Taft-Hartley Act to come out of this dispute?
No, I don't think
I don't think so. I think the main concern is the concern that they express. They feel that they must have, as management, the right to determine these crew sizes and, to put it broadly, to run the business.
But you don't. You think labor ought to...
I run my business better if I make friends with the people I'm working with. And we've been able to prove it. We produce as cheap as low hot metal as anybody in the country.
You don't have any fear that they may get control of your business?
No, I don't think so. I think there's certain responsibilities I have that I don't think they want.
Mr. Spivak.
Mr. Kaiser, do you think that the profit per ton of steel today is too high?
No.
Well, if you don't, how is industry going to give labor more and not be forced to raise prices and start again a spiral of inflation?
Through three areas. First, the normal productivity gain. Secondly, through technological improvement, such as the oxygen process. And thirdly, through a better relation with the union.
Yet you're not prepared to tell the people of this country or your own customers now that you will not raise prices. In spite of what you're going to have to give your labor.
No, that's right, Mr. Spivak.
Why is that?
The reason I was here, there's some things that I don't control. We buy lots of things. I don't know what the cost of some of the outside things are. And I also don't know what, when you're talking 2 years hence from now, I think I'm forecasting down the road pretty far to make any statement like that. But I can tell you we're going to bend our efforts toward not having any price increase.
I think at that point, gentlemen, I'll have to interrupt. I see that our time is up.
Monitor's thanks to Edgar F. Kaiser, chairman of the board of the Kaiser Steel Corporation, and the members of the Meet the Press panel for a stimulating and enlightening half hour.